Feel like talking?
Of course. What shall we talk about?
Scrolls, ancient ones from Chinese temples. What was on it?
I don't know. Usually these scrolls are merely a detailed survey of all the Emperor's possessions.
Dr. Benton hinted of something important. Did he tell you what it was?
No. He said the lecture was the time and place to reveal it.
Then his discovery may have been the reason for the murder and the theft.
I don't know. Merely as a museum piece, the scroll was very valuable.
Granted. But why couldn't it have indicated the location of some hidden treasure?
Mr. Wong, I believe you've been reading too many detective stories.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price. And we're going to talk about your brand new book that's out this month, as a matter of fact. And
just waiting on the proof copies right now.
Well, we'll be talking about that a little bit later on, and just adding to your prodigious output. And we also, before we get started, let me say that we have a winner of the two volume set. That we offered last podcast. And it's somebody from your neck of the woods, I think. We're talking about the Frederick Brown books from Hafner Press, of course. They're two giant, and they're beautiful books. I know you've been reading them. I have, too. I'm getting a new appreciation. I always liked Frederick Brown, but I'm getting a really new appreciation.
I'm torn between the new Frederick Brown anthologies from Hafner Press and the new first volume of the complete Jules de Grand.
Wow.
And then it's like... And then, of course, Joe Lansdale's got something new coming out often.
Right.
And it's like, drop everything, guys. This is I just read the first piece in the second Hafner Press Frederick Brown book last night, and boy, howdy. I mean, like, this story called Little Apple Hard to Peel.
Oh, I've read it in Dime Detective, and that
Coen Brothers movie.
My, I tell you, when they give you that last little thing at the very end, the line that the guy gives about Little Apple Hard to Peel, that is a tremendous story. A tremendous story. And it's a very Frederick Brown-esque, too, you know? I mean, it's...
And it's got a punchline, even though it's not in the least bit funny.
No. And, you know, we've always said, I know you and I have had this conversation before, that humor and horror are so much alike, because what, if you just, for instance, want to take the EC comics, so what Gaines and Feldstein did, and what they did was tell a story and then have a punchline at the end of it. It was not necessarily a funny punchline. But it was a punchline.
And it was a gut punchline.
That's right. And, it's very much the same thing. And that can extend certainly to that Frederick Brown story. And he's done others like that, too, of course. But that's one of my favorites.
I went back after reading Little Apple last night and pulled one of the Damon Runyons off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same thing.
And it's funny because you start thinking about that, Michael, and you start thinking about when Guys and Dolls or when Damon Runyon was doing his stuff, how many pulp people came along and were told to ape that first person slangy, you know, me and Biff are hanging out at the, you know, so-and-so, that whole Runyon-esque thing. I mean, Hugh B. Cave did some great ones in that style, and lots of people did that. But we're just happy. We want to do another shout out, I think, to Stephen Hafner for getting those books out. Number one,
these Frederick Brown books have come close to supplanting the Hugh Cave anthologies in my favor. That will never happen, of course, but they'll all, but of equal merit and import.
Yes.
and weight, the kind of story that stays with you.
That's right. That's exactly right. And if people want to know about those volumes, they can go to HafnerPress.com on the internet. But I'll tell you somebody who doesn't have to, and that's Daniel Sample. Daniel Sample of Sugarland, Texas. Are you near Sugarland at all?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, there
indeed,
you go.
Indeed, I'm trying to figure out a Sugarland story for the next Texas Horror Anthology.
Nice. Very nice. Well, Daniel is the one that was the first person to contact us and about the volumes, about the two-volume set, valued at $100. And so Daniel gets those two books. And congratulations, Daniel. We thank you, and we thank you for your support as well. And I know Stephen Hafner at Hafner Press thanks you. We can't really recommend those books enough. They're wonderful books. And anybody who loves the pulps, and even in that second volume, you know, there's stuff that's beyond the pulps. There's some very rare stuff he did for other publications, too.
Trade publications, right. Yes. A very fine humorist, of course.
Yes.
And stories written not for the general public, but for people in specific industries.
Right, right.
The drilling industry, the various industrial services, and how you can write dry trade journalism and make it comical.
Right.
I'm still trying to figure that out.
Right. Well, he does a fine job, and we've both done our apprenticeships of trade publications too. You and I. All right, let's go to Phantom of Chinatown now. That's the film we're talking about this evening. It came out from Monogram in 1940. And what I'd like to do before we get into the film, Michael, is sort of just set the scene for why Phantom of Chinatown and all the Mr. Wong films came out, because they came out at a time when there were a lot of Asian detectives in print and on film.
Right.
The other two probably most famous would be Mr. Moto, who was John P. Marquand's character that was played by Peter Lorre in the movies, and also, of course, Charlie Chan.
Charlie Chan,
and
yeah, good old Chuck.
I'm wondering, why do you think sociologically that the late 30s was, and very, I guess very late 30s, obviously, very early 40s, obviously before Pearl Harbor, as far as the Japanese detective, which Mr. Moto was, but what was in the cultural dream stream then to have all of these to be fertile ground for all of these detectives, Oriental detectives?
Well, of course, Earl Dare Biggers introduced Charlie Chan as early as the 1920s,
right?
In partly a response to the Western fascination with Asian protagonists.
I wonder about Asian antagonists, too.
Well, and partly as a backlash against the Asian antagonist phenomenon.
Fu Manchu being the best example, right?
Fu Manchu being the great example, and of course the innumerable Tong War movies.
That a
subgenre that was very uncharitably called the Yellow Peril.
That's right.
And of course, interesting to note that Charlie Chan, the most famous portrayer, had also portrayed Fu Manchu.
Would that be
Warner Oland?
Sure.
Yeah. Oland did a brief series of Fu Manchu movies at Paramount in the early talkie period, and then made the striking transition to Charlie Chan. He was a pretty good Fu Manchu, but he made a better Chan.
Right. Well, you know, I have read that this was the first time in the talkies. I'm talking about Phantom of Chinatown now. First time in the talkies that an American movie company used an Asian actor to play an Asian detective.
Quite so.
I mean, there were some in the silence. I know there's a little bit of in the silence, but not in the sound era before 1940.
This was a weird thing. The Monogram Pictures, the stepchild of Hollywood,
yes,
had kind of been backed into a corner because Monogram's bread and butter, in addition to Western films, was the horror film, mm-hmm. Mad Doctors, Supernatural Phenomena, what have you. Mm-hmm. And when the British Board of Censors and the European counterparts introduced a ban on American horror films about 1937, a lot of the American studios, well, gosh, the export market's one of our big bread and butter.
Sure.
Situations. What are we going to do? Well, you know, Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, careers stalled. Peter Lorre, not to that extent because he hadn't typecast himself so thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
Karloff, in particular, retrenched from being the boogeyman to becoming Mr. Wong,
mm-hmm.
which was like Monogram's answer to, to Fox's Charlie Chan pictures.
Right, and also to the Mr. Motos from, yeah.
And to the Mr. Motos from Fox. And, of course, the Motos and the Chans kind of crossed over from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
The escape hatch, or the relief for Karloff, was not necessarily to his liking, although he threw himself into the character. And when the ban on horror films was lifted in Great Britain and continental Europe, first thing Monogram wanted to do was wrap up Karloff's contract by giving him another, what Boris once called, a good old-fashioned horror pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, that being The Ape. Well, they had yet another Wong to finish, and Karloff was going to do The Ape, so what does Monogram do but put Ki Luke, the remarkable Asian actor you mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
into the Mr. Wong role? And it was like, gosh, this is really a streamlined Mr. Wong.
Right.
Immensely younger, maybe not more dynamic. Can anybody be more dynamic than Karloff? But Ki Luke had something to prove. And that something to prove was that at one time in the 30s, Fox had promised him Charlie Chan if anything should happen to Warner Oland.
I didn't know that.
So Ki Luke told me in an interview, oh gosh, right around 1990, he was mm-hmm. working with Woody Allen,
mm-hmm.
and we did a hell of a good interview, and we got into the Charlie Chan story, and he said, well, said Mr. Wong was kind of my consolation prize, although it didn't come from Fox.
Right. It came a few notches down the ladder, didn't it?
Well, Oland was, you might say, self-destructive. He drank himself to death.
Mm-hmm.
Carried a thermos of Tiger tea on every shoot.
What was Tiger tea, Michael?
Vodka.
Okay.
Yes. What was it? Ki Luke told me, said Oland would take a break, and Oland would take out two thermoses and nice hot tea for number one son, Tiger tea for honorable pop. It a terrible loss to the profession, but Ki Luke asserted himself with Fox management and said, well, I'm ready to take over Charlie Chan. Basically, he said they told him, get lost, kid.
So they just reneged on the promise.
Oh, yeah. I doubt he had it in writing.
Right, sure, no.
But and of course, replacement Charlie Chan's perfectly okay, but would have been interesting to see, because the greater irony is that Ki Luke did wind up playing Charlie Chan in a television cartoon
TV,
series.
That's right. Yep. That's right. And, you know, he's also in one of our favorite pictures, maybe my favorite motion picture of all time, How Do You Do, with Burt Gore and the Mad Russian. You know, Ki Luke acquits himself very well in that picture.
Playing a detective, of course.
Right, but it's another very low budget. I mean, it's PRC, which sometimes made Monogram look good, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
and those wonderful B-movies from studios that didn't have a B-movie unit. They were B-movie units.
They were the B-movie unit. They were the ones that filled out the bottoms of the bills, or sometimes, I guess, in rural situations, in smaller towns, the tops of the bills. But, you know, even the whole studio system, that's another story, because the studios that just put out B-pictures really had to scuffle and scrape to get bookings, right? Because they didn't own their own theaters, of course. Like the big, was it seven of them that did, or five of them that owned their own theaters back in the golden age?
It varied according to which way the antitrust winds
right,
were blowing.
Right. Well, so the way I understand it, Scott Dunlap, who was the head of production at Monogram, had signed exhibitors or had advertised that there would be four Mr. Wongs three Mr. Wongs for 1940. And when Karloff, when they decided that they'd make better use of Karloff's presence in The Ape, they still had a Mr. Wong left that they had to do. Is that pretty much the way it was?
That's pretty much the way it was. The Hugh Wiley fictional Wong, Mr. Wong franchise was fading out. It wasn't holding the audience.
It was almost exclusively in Collier's magazine, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah, they had a following. But the movies, you know, Karloff's general excellence notwithstanding, the movies were very uneven.
Right.
As to quality and presentation, you could tell that William Nye, the director, was, you know, just marking time.
And he directed all five of the Karloffs, right? They had a
all
different
all five
one
of the
for,
Karloffs, for and then yeah. he left, and then he went with Karloff to go do The Ape, and took most of the Mr. Wong crew with him.
Oh, okay. So that's why Phil Rosen is in for the Key Luke Mr. Wong, then.
Right, the director who is probably best known today for his low-budget pictures as a director, but in fact was one of the founders of the American Society of Cinematographers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Rosen had a pedigree like nobody's business.
Well, you know, Hugh Wiley's stuff was like the Mr. Moto stuff. It was, now, Mr. Moto was in Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, but Hugh Wiley, I guess the Hugh Wiley stuff was picked up or was optioned by Monogram after Fox got Mr. Moto. I guess that's how that worked. They were looking for something to enter the sweepstakes,
that would, that
right?
That would be a logical move for Monogram to make, doing their damnedest to compete with the larger studio.
And what would you say about the notion that I've run into when I've researched this film, that Monogram actually planned on more Mr. Wongs with Key Luke, and even announced more Mr. Wongs with Key Luke. Did he tell you anything about that when you did the interview?
No, we didn't talk about that because, of course, Phantom of Chinatown was the end of Mr. Wong.
Right, right.
Key Luke had larger ambitions, some of which paid off and some of which left him frustrated, although he had a very long and successful career.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, he was doomed to ethnic typecasting.
Right, right.
The greater versatility was not allowed to show through until many years later.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you know, a lot of stereotyping.
Right,
but
right.
The franchise was fading. I think Dunlap probably would have liked to go on with it if the interest and the enthusiasm had been there.
Mm-hmm.
But Phantom of Chinatown was not a hit picture.
No, that's what I understand. Although it's a pretty good looking picture. It looks,
it's a great,
you know,
looking
yeah.
picture. Rosen shot it like what you'd think of as a film noir.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with the crew and with Key Luke to, as I said, streamline the character of Mr. Wong. Still got the Oxford bearing, but is now addressed as Jimmy Wong instead of James Lee.
Right.
And Karloff had approached Wong as in a severely dignified manner. Key Luke's Jimmy Wong is a lot breezier. Is it the same guy? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so at all. You look at the Karloffs, you look at the Key Luke, and it doesn't seem to be coming at it from two entirely different places.
Oh, yeah, and there's a greater romantic inclination.
Yes, with Lotus,
and
with a great
with
Lotus Long, yes.
Lotus Long, uh-huh. yeah, and uh-huh. of course, good old dependable Grant Withers in backup.
That's right, who was in all of the Mr. Wongs, was he not?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
playing the same character, the detective, in the films. But, you know, there's some self-referential stuff in Phantom of Chinatown that's really interesting. And when he talks about, when Key Luke at one point talks about fictional mysteries, you know,
mm-hmm.
you get that little sort of self-referential thing. And, you know, he has a movieola, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, there's a bunch of things that make the, it's not a great film. It's very much a programmer. But, you know, there, I don't know why exactly. Perhaps you can tell me, Michael, but from time to time as we were watching, I was telling Joey that it looked, it had a Universal vibe to it almost, a Universal Pictures vibe.
I think that's because of the pep that Key Luke brings to the role.
Now, that's maybe right. Yeah. Yeah.
Universal's B pictures, especially the Mysteries and Spookers, usually featured, well, like Patrick Knowles,
mm-hmm.
an energetic detective.
Right, right.
Very much an attitude of well, what's the word for it? Pep.
Mm-hmm.
He's in precarious situations, but he's going to charge through like nobody's business.
Right, right. Very American in some ways, right?
Very American.
Right.
This is, in fact, Phantom of Chinatown is probably one of the most all-American, thoroughly, you know, can-do, get-with-it movies you'll find.
Well,
And that's a bit... that's a bit of a stretch for a series that had become somewhat stodgy.
Right. And this is not stodgy at all. It's brisk. The pacing is pretty brisk in it. You know? But it's still the one about the tomb with the curse, even though, you know, that's basically a red herring part of the plot. But there's nothing much new here except for Key Luke playing Mr. Wong. And, you know, I liked him in it. I would have, you know, in an alternate universe, he went on and did, you know, 20 of them or something for Monogram, and they did very well, because I would like to have seen him do another one. He wasn't Boris Karloff. He was not the antithesis of Boris Karloff, but he was a very different character.
No. And I'm looking at my notes from that Key Luke interview where he says... quoting, but anyhow, yes, I was very grateful to drop some hints of what I might have done as Chan
mm-hmm.
for that little Mr. Wong picture.
Mm-hmm. And he might have done a fine job at it, too.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, you know, the only bad Key Luke is no Key Luke.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, we're big Key Luke fans around here on the Forgotten Horrors podcast. And and really, you know, I've always liked, even though he's a little Grant Withers, he's doing his usual pushy kind of deal. You know, he was all over the place in those pictures in Poverty Row.
Street.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but not just in Poverty Row, but also he was doing B pictures at the major studios as well.
Sure.
He was just, I'm a big Grant Withers guy. Of course, he's in one of my favorite pictures because of Dan Turner, the only other Dan Turner movie besides the one that I wrote. And there's what, how many years separating those? About 32, 33 years. But he did Blackmail with mm-hmm. William Marshall, not the black actor, but the other William Marshall,
yep.
as Dan Turner. And I liked his role in that. I mean, he did play a lot of hardball detective guys with their hats stuck back on their heads and stuff, you know. And I
mm-hmm.
I get that. That was kind of what he did. But he does a good job here. I mean, it's a very pleasant, interesting picture.
And of course, I think all the characters, the recurring characters, Withers in particular, probably shine more in Phantom of Chinatown than in the previous Wongs, probably because of this really bright and engaging script by George Wagner.
Right.
You know, speaking of Universal.
There you go, yeah. That's right, yeah. What had he done at Universal before or after that he went to Universal?
That was during approximately the same period with I think, what, the Wolfman franchise.
Right, right. That's what I was thinking, too, yeah. Well, there you go. And it wasn't based on a Wiley story at all, was it? I think it was cut from whole cloth.
Wagner wrote the premise.
Mm-hmm.
And worked on and the final script with a co-writer. Of course, they took their cues from Hugh Wiley and
right.
then embellished from there.
Right, right, right. Well, we could recommend it. Joey found it. Where'd you find it, Joey? It was on YouTube. It was on YouTube. So, and that's the print that we watched. It was a very nice print.
That was great.
Yeah, it seemed to be a good print. So I think we'd recommend it just to take a look at everybody. If you know the Mr. Wongs, you generally know the Karloff Mr. Wongs because it's Karloff. But this is a pretty nice little alternative deal. And you're right, it kind of allows the supporting cast to shine a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly.
And nothing wrong with that at all. So I think we can both recommend that picture, and that it only takes about an hour out of your life anyway, because they got in and got out at Monogram.
Well, they were, I think, eager to find the way out and get back to doing what Monogram did best.
Oh, you think so? You think they wanted to get back to their horror pictures? Of course, you know, the whole Mr. Wong thing really started, it wasn't the Mr. Wong, but in 1935 they did that, what, Mysterious Mr. Wong with Lugosi?
Yeah, unrelated to the Hugh Wiley character, but certainly a Monogram.
So there's another Karloff Lugosi connection, right?
Indeed.
Tenuous though it may be. All right, Michael, what have you got that you would like to plug and we would like for the folks, if they are interested in seeing us eat, would like to promote tonight?
Well, I'm struggling against a deadline on finishing up the next two Forgotten Horrors books, but those, and they're not really on the back burner, but boy, I tell you what, juggling is an act that I don't recommend for anybody not committed to it.
No, I agree.
Right now I'm waiting on the proofs to arrive for the new collection. I hate that graphic novel isn't the term since it's an anthology, but the new comics anthology called Deep in the Horrors of Texas.
And I'm happy. I think I mentioned it early in the broadcast or the podcast, but I'm happy to say that I have a story in there. I'm glad that you picked one of my stories to include in that, even though I'm not from Baja, Oklahoma, as we like to say it here, not from your part of the country. I'm from Oklahoma instead, but you have a good reason for including the story, and I appreciate that.
Well, it's a hell of a good story, and one of those that works on levels of horrific thrills and a good humorous punchline.
That's what we like. We've been talking about punchlines, haven't we?
And and that job of art that Terry Tidwell turned in, embellished by Alfredo Alcala. Whoa, you know.
You know, that was originally, it's a story called Barbarian Morning, and not to give too much away, but that was originally set for Pacific Presents back in the heyday of the direct sales black and white comics. And Pacific Comics had a title where they would try out different things, and it was called Pacific Presents. And I have at home the original promotion they sent out to all of the comic book shops and all that sort of thing, saying, you know, this is the next thing coming up. And then Pacific Presents was canceled.
Oh, man.
And so that's why you've got it, and I'm glad that you do.
Well, it's a beauty.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We've got, if you want to go to my website, Michael's website, actually, you go to Amazon.com and look at either one of us, and there's a pretty much, you know, I'm not going to say it's the jack of all trades, master of none deal, but it certainly is a variety of books that we have done both together and separately. And I suspect we're going to keep on doing it, too.
I see no end in sight, and that's a good thing.
I don't either. So, once again, we want to thank Daniel Sample and congratulate him for winning the books from Hafner Press. Check out the Hafner Press website, and we appreciate very much Hafner Press and Stephen Hafner making those books available to us to give away here on the Forgotten Horrors podcast. Michael and everyone, thank you, and we'll be back before you know it.
Delighted.